This week we get to start a new Sefer. So we get to begin Sefer Shmos together. And we are, perhaps by now, we are very familiar with the story of Sefer Shmos, the slavery of the Jews in Egypt. So Parsha Shmos is the beginning of that story. Right? It recaps the coming down to Egypt and then the beginning of Egypt's plan to enslave the Jewish people. There's the whole mess with the midwives and the birth of Moshe and Moshe's conversation at the Sneh. Okay, so all these things are part of the Parsha. Moshe speaks to Hashem at the burning bush, and he is convinced eventually to go on this mission to save the Jewish people, right? So now, after all that beginning, Moshe finally heads off to Egypt to confront Paro and to, in theory, convince him to let the Jewish people go. So we're told that he returns on his way back and he meets Aaron. Right, that's another part of the story, that Aaron is reintroduced back into the story as the spokesperson. Right, he's kind of Moshe's right-hand man during this mission. And in source one, it said, "Vayilech Moshe ve'Aharon, vayi'asifu es kol ziknei b'nei Yisrael." So Moshe and Aaron go, and they gather all of the elders of b'nei Yisrael. Okay, this is a Canaan. So they go and they organize the elders together. Vayidaber Aharon es kol ha'dvarim asher diber Hashem el Moshe. And Aaron says all of the things that God told to Moshe. So, you know, Aaron's already stepping up as the mouthpiece of this whole mission, right? So Aaron is there because he's the one who, right? As Moshe said, like, I'm not going to be so convincing. We need somebody who's actually going to be able to say the words. So Aaron takes that. Vayas ha'osos le'enei ha'am. And he does all of the signs that, let's just say all of, but he does the signs that that Hashem gave to Moshe in front of the people. So this is a reference to the fact that earlier in the story, while Moshe is talking to God, so Hashem tells him, gives him some signs, right, in order to convince the people that he is legit. So Moshe says, how are they going to believe me? And Hashem gives him some signs, right? There's tzaras, and there's the blood, and there's the snake. So not in that order, right? I think I did it wrong, but there are three signs. So, they seem to, you know, come. Aaron gives a speech. They do the signs, and then vayaamein ha'am, and then the nation believes, right? So the nation vayaamein, like emunah, like they believe the message. Vayishmeu ki fakar Hashem es bnei Yisrael. Right, and they hear that God has remembered the Jewish people, v'chi ra'as on yam, and that God saw their pain, v'yikdu v'yishtachavu. So they bow, right, in praise of Hashem, in recognition that God has seen what they're going through. So they bow. Okay, so that is the people's reaction. Right? The people's reaction is v'yamein ha'am. Everybody believes Moshe.
The elders.
What?
The elders
believe Moshe. Okay, fine. So it sounds like Vayamin Ha'am, though. It does say Ha'am. So maybe we want to figure out maybe the Am is not really the full Am. Okay, but so that's something to talk about. So Vayamin Ha'am, it sounds like the nation believes, is literally right what we might translate that. And
they gathered these, came to come with them, but they did it before the whole Am, if you look in. Second.
Right, but yeah, so it says, yeah, you kind of have to figure out the exact timeline because it says they gathered the Zekanim and Aaron speaks and then they do the Osos in front of the nation. So, you know, that sequence of events that the Zekanim, when do the Am kind of like join the party? Is it after Aaron's speech and then they do the signs or like, do they gather the Zekanim because that really is what brings out the rest of the people? So there's a little bit to discuss. But Vayamin Ha'am, the nation believes. So it is interesting to note because we continue to have a similar phrase that shows up, right? This is not actually the only time that the people believes. For example, at the end of the Pesach story, so this is Parshas in source two is Parshas Beshalach. We have the Jewish people have gone through the Makos, they've gone through the 10 plagues, and they have finally actually walked out of Egypt. So Parshas Beshalach is when they are on their way. This is the introductory paragraph to Az Yashir. So we have the Song of the Sea, right? After Egypt is finally kind of, the army is finally destroyed, and the Jewish people look back, and the pasuk says, "Vayari Yisrael asiyad ha-gadola asher asa Hashem b'Mitzrayim," and the Jewish and Yisrael saw the great hand that God had done in Mitzrayim. "Vayiru ha-ames Hashem," and the people, the nation, feared God. "Vayaminu b'Hashem v'Moshe avdo," and they believed God. They believed in God and Moshe. So we have this phrase again, that "Vayaminu," why do I need this phrase again, right? So we already have, at the beginning of the story, Moshe shows up, and it says, "Vayamein ha'am," that they believe him. And then, later on it says, and they also believe, and also they believe...
Well, in between, there was a lot of complaining going on, a lot of
okay.
stuff happened, and they said, "Why did you take us out to kill us in the sea?" And then after it was all done, and then they saw the Egyptians, they're dead, and they're still alive, so then it was the final belief.
Okay, so one suggestion is, Vayamin Ha'am means that they believed, but somewhere along the way, that belief was challenged, let's say, right? So they went through, they saw all the different plagues in Egypt, and, you know, they were on board. But then when they left Egypt, then they were stuck between a rock and a hard place. Right, they're stuck at the sea, and they see the armies chasing them, and they're like, "What's going to happen? It's all over. You should have just left us in Egypt, right?" And then they're miraculously saved, and you know their faith is reignited, right? So now they believe anew. So that might be a suggestion, right? That may also kind of align with perhaps part of what Rashi says when Rashi describes that following. Our first source, right, as you start Perek Hey. So the pasuk says in Perek Hey, right, they've now riled up the people, they've called the Zakenim, they've done the Osos in front of the Am, they've like riled up this whole group of people, and everybody's cheering and like, "Yeah, let's go, we're gonna leave," and then Moshe says, "All right, Taparo," and then they all start walking to Paro, and then when Moshe stands in front of Paro and says, "We're here," and then turns around, and nobody's there, right? I mean, Rashi doesn't exactly say it like that, but Rashi says that as they walk to Paro, people start kind of like filtering off, right? It when the rubber hits the road, and it's like they actually have to stand up to Paro, everyone kind of backs out, right? And Rashi says that points. So to the point from before, Rashi says the Zakenim all left, and that's why the Zakenim don't get to be a part of Matan Torah in the same way that they would have, so that it sounds like there's a focus on the Zakenim in that case. But it sounds like when Moshe gives a speech, everybody's on board, but really already from the very beginning, according to Rashi, like when their faith is like really tested, like do they really, they believe, but like are they really there? Maybe not so much. So maybe they lose it a little bit when they're actually faced, and then they have to regain it. So maybe that's what Rashi means. I'm also alluding, there's like a little bit of a slightly different tack, which is maybe there are different levels of belief. Right? This is also something just to think about. That when we say Vayamein, right, when you believe, then it kind of refers to this in Shir Shirim, that like when we say, you know, when you say you believe, like I can believe in theory, right? But then, like, does it really come out in the way I behave? Like, okay, maybe that's like a different level. So maybe they're like different kinds of, they're different stages of belief.
I was wondering, you know, in the discussion that the Rabbanu Shalom has with Moshe, he tells him, "You're going to ask Paro to let the people go. He's going to say no."
Right.
And, you know, and then I'm going to bring afflictions to him or whatever. He's still going to say no. Eventually, I'm going to kill his kids and then you're going to get out. So when he came and he he collected the Zakenim, and it says that he said everything. Did he tell him this? In which case the people would say, okay, we'll go along with this, you know, but we'll see what happens.
So is there, to that point, that we don't know exactly how the message is passed on to the people, or we could, again, we can maybe explore the psukim and try to, like, pull out more information. But you can also imagine that, like, right, to the point about when your faith is challenged, right, if they know going into it, like, guys, we're going to get out, but it's going to be a roller coaster, right? Like, it's going to, right, we're going to fight for it, and he's going to say no. Like, so they know going in, but if Moshe just comes and, like, we're getting out, and then the first big roadblock, they're like, hey, wait a second. You just promised we were going to leave, right? So that may be even more of, like, a slap in the face, right? Which is a little bit of a different point. But, like, again, this idea about, like, how much, right, when he tells them everything, do they know that he's going to say no? Or, like, are they ready to kind of, like, ride it out with him and see where it lands? Or, right, would that give them more faith or less, perhaps, right? Maybe they're not really so into it, right? Exactly. So maybe, right, to your point. So that's an interesting thing to think about. You know, Moshe's message may also kind of apply. What is Moshe's message to the people? What does he bring to them when he tells them everything that Hashem said? So this question, that overall question about the emuna, the faith of the Jewish people in Mitzrayim, and how does it change over the course of the story? So we said, first of all, it could be that, like, they had faith, and then they, like, lost it, and then they regained it, and then maybe it's kind of like an ebb and flow that goes back and forth. We suggested, I just mentioned the second idea, something also to kind of keep in mind and explore maybe as we're reading through the Parsha, just in general, as you're going through the story and rethinking about it, think about maybe, like, different levels of faith, right? Maybe at the beginning, right, a slave has, like, a particular type of faith. But then once they're freed, right, you're able to expand into a different way of thinking. So maybe that's like a second approach.
I need some clarification here.
Yeah.
Hashem doesn't lay out his whole plan
yeah.
At a time.
Right.
He tells, to my understanding, he tells Moshe, you're going to do this. And they're going to say no, but I will be with you.
Right.
That's what everybody. That's what we know. That's what we know.
So in this case, there was a question, which is when Moshe comes and says God's going to take us out. So first of all, there was like a little bit of a discussion that we just had. It was when it says that they pass on to the people everything that God said. Do they pass on? God said he's going to take us out, or do they pass on? God said he's going to take us out, and also Paro's going to say no, and things are going to get crazy, which is like the general broad message that right, that God says, like, but I'm going to make sure it happens anyway, right?
Eventually, right. God's going to take us
yeah.
out.
So if that's the message, right? Let's say that's the message, and if that's the message to the Jewish people, so here it says that the people believe Moshe and they're bought in. And they're on board with this whole plan. But later on in the story, it tells us again that they are bought in and on board with Moshe and with Hashem. So that the main question we're dealing with is really, like, why does it say Vayamin Ha'am early in the story? And then later on, you know, at the end of the story, when God really, like, you know, shows his hand, as it were, right? So then they're like, oh, okay, Vayaminu b'Hashem. Now they believe in God. Like, what do you mean? That was how the story started. They believed at the beginning, and they believe at the end. So why do I have to be told both of those, right? Why do I have to be told they believed at the beginning and at the end?
But God doesn't give them, I'm going to do A, and then
right.
I'm going to do B, and
right.
then I'm going to do C.
And therefore, right, God doesn't reveal it all ahead of time, and therefore?
Therefore, of course you'll believe in me.
Okay, so but if at the beginning they already have faith, if they believe the process, and they're like, I don't know what's going to happen.
They're developing the process.
But if they trust in the process at the beginning, so then why do I have to be told at the end that they trust God? Right? Like, if I trust at the beginning, and I made it through all of those complicated steps, then at the end, why do I have to be told? Vayamino, and they believe. Right? It's once I say it at the beginning, if they're already through there, so like, what? Right? What? They've seen all the plagues, right? They've seen all the great things that have happened. So, so one way to explain it would be they had faith at the beginning. Something must have happened in between, which made it, let's say, like which they, I don't want to say lost it completely, but like in which it was weakened or something like that. And then they returned to a state of having faith. So that was kind of one suggestion that we brought up, that it says it at the beginning and the end because it must have like stopped in the middle somewhere. And you'd have to, right, we'd have to discuss like why would it stop in the middle? And then again, so that's like these couple of ideas, whether it stops in the middle or whether it's just like it grows to a different level or there's a different kind. So those are two kind of approaches. But I would like to explore a little bit of a different approach, which I want to bring up because I think it kind of it changes our perception a little bit, perhaps of the slavery that's going on in Egypt. We kind of take the I think we have like a little bit of a broad perspective on what was happening during the slavery in Egypt, which is shifted slightly over the course of some of the sources that we're going to see. So let's start with this piece from Rav Soloveitchik on the Haggadah. So Rav Soloveitchik, So there are different Rav Soloveitchik. This is Rav Yosef Dov Soloveitchik, but not the original one. Right. This is Rav Joseph Baer Soloveitchik from Boston, NYU. So this would be the original. The reason I said Rav Yosef Dov, we should know the name. That there was the I don't even know if the original one was the original one. Yeah. So those. I might refer to as the Rav Soloveitchik. His great grandfather, right? So he was named after his great grandfather, who was also Rav Yosef Dov Soloveitchik. But his great grandfather is more commonly known as the Beis Halevi. So the Beis Halevi is one of the early, you know, like the beginning of the dynasty that we often talk about of the Soloveitchik family. Even though they also came from a family before that, but the Beis Halevi, his son was Rav Chaim Soloveitchik, Rav Chaim Brisker. Rav Chaim had two sons. So one of them was Rav Moshe, and Rav Moshe ended up in America. And Rav Moshe had two sons, Rav Aaron and Rav Yosef Dov. Again, this Rav Soloveitchik is the one this is the one who taught in YU, but his father also taught in YU. So he kind of took over after his father passed away. So this is the Rav. This is Rav Soloveitchik from Boston and New York. So this is a collection of different ideas, and he has a thought here on the Haggadah. One idea of using Haggadah was I wanted to kind of we learned through the Parshios of Mitzrayim, and we also have Pesach, right? And like one of the ideas I was trying to think about this week is that there are certain ideas that Pesach is trying to reveal to us about Yetzias Mitzrayim, right? There are certain things that we do at the Seder, or that perhaps if we actually really look in the Haggadah, right, if we went through in the Haggadah all of those psukim that we quote, right, Vayareos anu amitzrayim, vayaninu, Vayareos anu kemoshana, right, and it like we quote all these psukim back, right, that medrash is an actual commentary, right? So if we actually looked through what Chazal are trying to tell us about the actual Mitzrayim story, right, by connecting those psukim, so I think there's something to kind of build on. There's kind of more to think about, not just to have them as two separate ideas, and also not just to try to cheat and be like, oh, here's a I have to talk about Shmos this week. Like I'll just quote a Pesach thing. But I think if we use the Haggadah and our story on Pesach to kind of reveal, so that while we're learning the Parsha of Shmos, to really think about those ideas together, was kind of my thinking. So I have a couple of points from the Haggadah that hopefully will reveal a little bit more about the actual Pesach story. So this is about Yachatz. We have this at the Seder, we have Yachatz. So Yachatz is the part of the Seder when we split our matzah in half. Why do we split our matzah in half?
It's like poor man's bread.
What does poor man's bread mean?
They eat a piece now and save a piece.
Great. Okay, so poor people, they split it in half because they don't know where their meal is going to come from. So let's save some for later, right? So I can't eat all of it now because I don't know what's going to be in the future. Okay, so that's the regular understanding of poor man's bread. So the Rav has a little bit of a different spin on it. So he says the following. We break the matzah as a symbol of the poor man's bread that the Jewish slaves ate in Egypt. One way of understanding that is that a poor person who can never know where his next meal is coming from breaks off a piece and saves it for later. Okay, great. So Rav Soloveitchik offered a different interpretation of the poor man's bread. He has a different take on it. Although when we think of the enslavement of the Jewish people in Egypt, we usually think that all the Jews must have been equally burdened by it. But in truth, that was not so. Right? So we think, we paint it with a very broad brush. Everybody is a slave, and therefore everybody is having the same experience. But that's not the case. There were various degrees of slavery. Some Jews lived under better conditions and some worse. According to our sages, one of the tribes, the tribe of Levi, was never enslaved. Okay, so what that means is that some had access to food and some did not. Right? So again, they're all slaves, and no one's saying that they're having a good experience. But they're not all having the same experience. They are all in different places. So at this, right, what he is arguing is that we have to add a little nuance into recognizing like the human experience of slavery is not going to be the same for everybody. And that means in a practical sense, some people have more resources than others, right? They're all slaves, but some have more resources than others. Those that did, claims Rav Soloveitchik, broke their bread and shared it with other Jews who had less. So he says, Yachatz is a way that we remember. Why do we break? Because in Mitzrayim, when we were at the bottom, when we basically had nothing, still those who had more made sure to break their bread and share it with somebody else. That's why we split our bread. Because no matter who you were, when you were in Mitzrayim, you didn't eat all of it because there were other people to take care of. So you made sure to split it. The Jews who were enslaved in Egypt would split their piece of matzah and share it with the poor who needed it. Hence the term poor man's bread. That's what lechem oni, when we talk about poor man's bread, that's what we're referring to. This is symbolized by the act of breaking the matzah in half. Okay, so that is yachatz. So that's Rav Soloveitchik's suggestion for yachatz is not because I am the poor man and therefore I have to make sure to hide some away so that I can find it later, but we reenact, we remember this act of chesed, that they did in Egypt, that they would split their matzah so that those who had more were able to still share with those who had less. Okay, so Rav Soloveitchik is perhaps expanding our vision of the slavery in Egypt to say that even though everybody is a slave, still there are some people who have access to more resources than others. It brought to my mind. There's a discussion when Bnei Yisrael are in the desert and they're complaining and they talk about, oh, we remember the fish and the vegetables and all the stuff we used to get. So the obvious question, right, is they were slaves, right? They remember all these delicacies that they got. They used to get. They used to get all sorts of great vegetables, right? They had an overflowing salad and fish, right? Is that really what they had? And right, they had matzah. They had bread. What could they have possibly had? So that's one of the reasons that Rashi brings from Chazal that maybe they're referring not to food, but they're referring to something else, right? In kind of a roundabout way. Because of that, right, partially because of that obvious question, like what kind of food could they get? But the Ramban, it reminds me of the Ramban who says that, think about if you're a slave. So if you're a slave in the field, so then what do you have access to? Just the stuff in the field. And if you're a slave to somebody, to a fisherman, then what happens? You work on the boat, and then at the end of the day, they toss you some fish, whatever it is, right? Like, if, depending on where you worked, you had different things. Right, so even the Rishonim, the Ramban already is kind of the Ramban is not talking about sharing it, right? But he's referring to the fact that over the course of their time, depending on where you were, you had different stuff, right? You had a different, you did not necessarily all have the same experience. So we think of slavery And we think of, oh, well, they were building, right? They were building cities, right? So we know that they are, and the Psukim refer to the fact that they're building the cities, right? And by the end of Parsha Shmos, it gets even harder to build the cities, because now they have to get their own materials, they have to do it themselves, right? All of that. So that, if we only think of that, though, right, what starts to happen is that that becomes what we think of as the entirety of the experience in Mitzrayim. And what some of these sources are pointing out is that's not really the case, right? That may be the case even for the majority, even if we assume it's for the majority of the Jewish people, that they are involved in these huge construction projects, right? That they're the ones who are dragging the bricks and putting them up and moving things around. So maybe that is the case, but that's not the case for everybody. Right, so you have a mixture. You have different kinds of people in Mitzrayim. Okay, so that's the first piece that we want to recognize that that even in Mitzrayim, even when they are slaves, they're not all having the same experience. So some people, live up to the challenge, and they're the ones who are splitting their bread. Right, they recognize I'm able to get a little bit more food. Let me make sure that you also have food on your table. So some people are able to meet that head on, and they're able to continue to share. And that's what we remember with Yachatz. The Netziv is in source 4. He is Rav Naftali Svi Yehuda Berlin. That's the acronym Netziv. The Netziv actually was. As we were just talking about Rav Soloveitchik, so Rav Soloveitchik's grandfather was Rav Chaim. Rav Chaim was, co-Rashi Yeshiva with the Netziv in Volozhin. So Volozhin was like the premier yeshiva, right? It was the yeshiva of the day in the late 1800s and at the time of the Netziv. So the Netziv and Rav Chaim were Rashi Yeshiva at the same time. They both kind of ran the yeshiva. And they like split the time that they would give shiur and things like that. So the Netziv precedes the Rav Soloveitchik that we just read. He precedes him by a little bit. But the Netziv says the following in his commentary on the Haggadah. So he's discussing Avadim Hayinu. Avadim Hayinu Lafaro b'Mitzrayim. We were Avadim to Paro. So we're not going to go into his whole discussion about the different ways that Chazal described the slavery and the Exodus, but he points out the following in that discussion. He says, "Ka hayu b'Yisrael, kama alafim urivavos shelo ratzu latzeis ba'asher hayu ashirim." He says, he argues that there were thousands, tens of thousands of Jewish people who did not want to leave. Because they were ashirim, they were rich. They were getting rich off of this whole thing. Umehem shahiyu gadolei hamalucha. And there were people who were very, very, they were in prominent positions. They were well connected. Ki hamon Yisrael lo avdu lahamon Mitzrayim. Because there were a lot of people who were not enslaved to the common people. Ela lamalchus. There were a lot of people who were in the service of royalty, of the leadership, of people of power. So when they were there, as we said, there are a lot of people who are out there building. There are a lot of people who are out there, in the everyday homes of random Egyptians. But you also have a lot of people who are not there. You have a lot of people who are just part of the complex hierarchy of Egypt who are not out in the fields. Ukidetanya b'toras kohanim, as it says in the Medrash, mios lahem avadim. So the Medrash says that he took them from being slaves lahem of them. V'lo hayu avadim la avadim. Okay, arkan l'shono. So he's referring to the Medrash. Okay, but he points out in a few places that this seems to be the reference when we say avadim hainu lef paro. Right? Not only did God save us, but he also took us out, even though there were people who were slaves directly to Paro. Right? There are slaves who were well connected. And he points out in Sefer Shmuel, you have another reference to the fact to being in the service of the king or in service of Paro or in service of, right? So that language, the Netziv argues, is always a reference to the fact that there were a lot of people in Mitzrayim who are not you know, sullying their hands out in the field, but are actually rubbing shoulders with the bigwigs in Egypt, right? So those people who have enough of a connection, Al-Kain, therefore, Harbim Him, Shemonu V'Heshiru, Shemenu V'Heshiru, right? So a lot of them, they're getting rich off of this. They're well-connected. They have resources. They have all sorts of stuff. U'Behefkera Me'ol Malchus Shemaim. And they get it. In this case, he's saying they get it without that having to worry about their relationship to God, right? They don't have all of these quote unquote like oppressive Torah rules, right? They are connected enough. So then, v'lo rachu lasheis. So why should we even bother leaving? Ulishtabed ba'ol Torah v'avoda. We're going to go take on this whole new commitment. Why should we bother with that? Avalaf al pichein akash berachu tzis Yisrael. But even though there was such resistance that was, you know, within the Jewish people, right, within that system, there's resistance to leaving, and Hashem was still took us out of Mitzrayim. So the Netziv, I want to push like a little further, right? We said from Rav Soloveitchik and pointing out from this Ramban that when we think about Mitzrayim, we have this broad view of everybody having the same life, but not everybody has the same life, right? So Rav Soloveitchik kind of expands that and points out not all slaves are having the exact same experience. And the Netziv goes even further. The Netziv expands it even further and says, and you know what? The people who are actually dealing with royalty and those who are rich, they themselves are also getting rich off of the experience. They're also pretty comfortable, right? They're also doing okay for themselves. And they don't necessarily want to leave in the same way that everybody else wants to leave.
Does the Netziv go on to say that these are the 80% that didn't go out?
Yes. So he has a little reference later on. When he talks about, he refers to his own commentary later on when we talk about Dever, right? There's like a reference to Dever, but he elaborates a little bit that when we talk about, in the end, not all of the Jewish people leave, right? Why not? So those people who stay in Mitzrayim and die in Mitzrayim during Choshech is usually the time we point to. So during the darkness, there's some segment of the Jewish population that dies because they don't want to leave, and he says that was this group. So we have this, again, hopefully a slightly more complex version of what's going on in Mitzrayim, recognizing that that it's not the same for everybody. Not only do some people have more and can share more, but there are also people who have more and probably are not sharing more, right? They're the ones who figured out enough of a connection to those in power to for themselves to essentially be in power. They don't necessarily all want to leave. So if that is the case, so I think if we think about when Moshe comes with his message, and it says, Vayamein Ha'am, the nation believes him, and they're ready to go. And they're ready to get out of there. So especially with this kind of balancing between it says Vayamein Ha'am, but we're still kind of referring to the Zakenim, right? They were really the focus of this conversation. And in the next pasuk, when Rashi says that they all disappear, Rashi focuses on the Zakenim disappearing, right? So if that's the case, then Vayamein Ha'am, in the beginning of the story, who really believes Moshe? Who's bought into Moshe's message? Is everybody on board in the same way? Probably not, right? So when Moshe comes and he gives his rallying speech and everybody's cheering, right, there are probably some groups at the back who are like looking around at everybody else cheering, like, yay, trying to fit in a little bit, right? Just trying to feel the crowd. So what happens is that when Moshe comes and people are on board with him and they believe him, that may not be the case across the board. I think Chazal do this in different places, and you know where we look at something that of the Jewish people of Bnei Yisrael, and then Chazal will point out. Also, obviously, it's more complex than that because you also have a group that's saying this, and you have a group, right? Sometimes Chazal will explain. This comes up also by the Yom Suf, where it sounds like people are having like almost like contradictory reactions, and Chazal will say, no, it's because it's different groups, right? It makes sense, right? That out of this whole nation of people, they don't all have the same reaction. Some people are arguing this, some people are arguing for that, right? So Chazal will do that sometimes and point that out in the Medrash as a way to right, one of the insights into like psukim that don't seem to line up exactly. Again, it's not if you have psukim that don't line up, right? So there are different sources of evidence, there are different things, but that's like one of the tools, like one of the responses. So so if that's the case, so now we have a Jewish people who is maybe not all on, they're not all on the same page. They actually maybe perhaps some are have a little bit more emuna at the beginning than others. Right, so we've changed it a little bit, and if that's the case, I also want to point to. We'll do source six first. Let's look at source six. Source six is a pasuk in Yeshayah. So this actually comes from this week's Haftorah. So in the Haftorah, we are told v'haya bayom hahu. This is from Yeshayah, Isaiah. He says v'haya bayom hahu on that day yitaka b'shofar gadol. The great shofar will sound. So this also, by the way, right, we should realize that like the language of our tefillah, right, this if we recognize that phrase from Shemoneh Esrei, Tka b'shofar gadol l'cheruseinu, so that, right, it's rooted in the psukim. So on that day, he will blow the great shofar, and what will happen when this is sounded in the world? Uvau ha'ovdim be'eretz Ashur v'hanidachim be'eretz Mitzrayim. They will the lost ovdim here with an aleph. So the lost ones in the land of Assyria, they will come. V'hanidach in Beretz Mitzrayim, and those who are spread out in the land of Mitzrayim, v'ishtachavu l'Hashem behar hakodesh, and they will bow to Hashem in Yerushalayim. Okay, so on this day in the future, when the shofar is sounded, right, when the message is clear and the message goes out, and God calls the Jewish people, we will return from Ashur and we will return from Mitzrayim. So why these two places? Why these two places? And why put Ashur and then, right, they're going to come from Ashur and from Mitzrayim. Why are these, what should we get from these two places? And also, right, I mean, to some extent, like the order. Why from Ashur and from Mitzrayim? So the Vilna Gaon, we're gonna point out an idea that from the Vilna Gaon, and then we'll connect it to a bigger idea. So the Gra in source five, I wrote Gra. That's the Vilna Gaon, Rav Elio. So he says the following. He says we have to recognize when it comes to Avodah Zarah, right? We talk about Avodah Zarah, idol worship, right? Misaligning our philosophy. Right, something that's heresy, something that where we are not worshiping God. So where does Avodah Zarah, what's the root, where does that come from? So he says, Shtei Avodos Zaros. There are two Avodah Zarahs. Achas she'ovdim ledavar miskayim la'olam, ve'heim ha'ovdim bishvil olam haba. There are some people who worship idols because they are trying to connect to something eternal. They are doing it for Olam Haba. They're doing it for a philosophical reason. They are trying to connect to something greater than themselves. They are trying to connect to spirituality. And they're in the wrong, they're not finding it. They're finding it in the wrong place. They're worshiping idols because philosophically they're trying to connect to Olam Haba. To Olam Haba, meaning the next world. The Hashinis, the second kind of Avodah Zarah, Ha'ovdim Bishvil Olam Hazeh. People who worship idols, not because of Olam Haba, not because of some philosophical idea, but because of Olam Hazeh. Because really they're trying to connect to this world. U'ledavar she'en miskayim. And that will usually be reflected in something that is not eternal. Something very grounded, something very specific. So he's arguing the different kinds of Avodah Zarah reflect people's greater intention, right? Are they worshiping the sun, something that's like beyond and something that's further than where I am? Or are they worshiping, right, something, Baal Peor, something that's like very grounded and something that doesn't last? And, right, it's a completely different type of Avodah Zarah. So he says there are two kinds of Avodah Zarah. There's an Avodah Zarah, even though we talk about heresy and idol worship, we talk about that from the... He says there are really two kinds. Some people are doing it for Olam Haba. Some people are doing it for Olam Haza. People are really just doing it for this world. They're just trying to connect better to the world that we're in. Rav Tzadok, so Rav Tzadok HaKohen, he writes the following. I think it's in the introduction to, it's in one of the Art Scroll, I think it's the introduction to Koheles. I think they bring this down. So in like, when they have like the separate volumes, one for each Megillah. So I think in Koheles, I think it's in that one. So Rav Tzadok says the following. He says, and you have two different kinds of people. You have some people who are, who they really want to understand. Why do they lack faith in God, right? Why are they off the path? Because they're searching. They're really trying to understand. They really want to explore. They really want to, to really connect to Olam Haba. But they're looking in the wrong place. They somehow got knocked off, their path, and now they're in the wrong place. So they're searching. They're trying to be better, but they're just doing it in the wrong place. He says that's Ashur. Ashur is not an easy place to live. Ashur is, right, is rocky. It's out in the desert. It's a place that is rough to live in. So those people who are there, they're working hard. They're trying. They're working to eke out a living. But they're in exile. They're just in the wrong place. So he says that that is a mashal, right? These people literally living in Ashur. He says that's a mashal for the kind of people who are off the path religiously. They're off somewhere else, but they're working. They're trying to find the truth. They're just not in the right place. That's Ashur. When it comes to Mitzrayim, what kind of place is Mitzrayim? Mitzrayim, as in Tanakh, is a it's like almost the mashal of an easy place to live, of a place that is reliable, right? How do they get their food? Because of the Nile. It goes through a cycle, right? So you're able to, right? You're not living out in the desert that relies on the rain that maybe happens or maybe sometimes doesn't happen, but the Nile River has a cycle and it goes through, and that's how you farm your land, right? When Lot is looking for a place, right, he finds Sodom, and what, right? It looks so great. It looks like Mitzrayim, right? That's what he thinks. He's like, okay, let's go there. That'll be a good place to set up camp, to set up my life, because it's like Mitzrayim, right? Mitzrayim is a place where things are easy, where we are easily connected to the things in this world. So Rav Tzadok says, you have two kinds of people. You have some people who they're searching and they're working hard and they're trying to get at the truth. They're just in the wrong place. And you have other people, they're not really the ones who are searching. They're in the wrong place because it's easier, right? They're in Mitzrayim because it's enticing, because it's exciting, because it's easy to live there. So what happens? Yitaka b'shofar gadol. What happens at the end of days when the message is finally clear? People will come back, but who are going to be the first ones to come back? Who are going to be the first ones to come back? The people who are actually searching, the people who are actually interested, the people who want to know the truth. So when the truth reveals itself, uva'u ha'ovdim be'eretz Ashur. Those who are searching for the truth, when they see it, they're going to recognize it and they're going to come back. They're going to make sure they'll be the first ones back. And eventually, when it cannot be argued with anymore, then you know who else is even going to come back? Those people who don't really want to be there, they actually were happy in Mitzrayim. The people who aren't really searching for the truth, but when the truth is so clear, even they can't argue, then also hanidachim be'eretz Mitzrayim. Even the people from Mitzrayim will also come back. Those will return from Mitzrayim. It'll come afterwards, though. It's not going to be the first, right? The first group to come back are going to be the people who are interested, the people who want, the people who are looking for to understand, the people who are looking for growth, looking for spirituality. The Avodah Zarah of to borrow from the Gra, the Avodah Zarah, those who are you know, involved in the Avodah Zarah of Olam Haba. So when they see real Olam Haba, when they see real spirituality, it's going to pull them in. And the people who are in Avodah Zarah for Olam Hazeh, they're really in it because it's comfortable. It'll take a little bit longer for them to really, to say, I'm just lying to myself, right? At some point, I'm gonna see the truth and go along with it. So this message in Yeshaya is from our Haftorah is painting again this picture that you have people in different places. You have two people who may look like they are doing the same thing, right? You may even have, again, the Yeshaya message is Ashur versus Mitzrayim, right? Geographically, they're in different places. But conceptually, the idea that you can have two people who are involved in Avodah Zarah, as the Gra says, right? You have two people who are off the path, but they're there for very different reasons. What's underlying them is very different things. And if you are actually somebody who is a truth seeker, so then you're much more likely that when Moshe shows up, when Moshe comes to town and says, I have a message from God. Okay, I'm going to listen. What's the message? What do you have to say? Right? He has to bring osos. He's got to speak the right language. Okay, so we've got to make sure that Moshe knows what he's talking about. But I'm going to listen. Right? It's a lot easier for it to get them first. So v'yamin ha'am, there are some people that go along with Moshe's message. And they are bought in right away. They're ready to go. They're already ready to listen. It could be that there are some people in Mitzrayim who have more than the rest of the slaves. And not only that, but as the Nitziv says, they actually have a lot more. They're actually pretty comfortable. And some of them, we might say some of them are too far gone, whatever that means for right now. We're just going to simplify and say some of them die in Mitzrayim. But to say that, again, if we're recognizing that there's like a complexity here, it's not like, oh, now there are two groups. You're either in or you're out. But they're people. There are people who are in a wide spectrum of experience in the world. So you have some people who are like, leave Egypt over my dead body. And God says, okay. And then they die in Choshech and then we leave. Okay? Right? And then there are some people who I don't know, like, things are not so bad, like, right? Like, so I'm not really a slave to Paro, but like, it's okay. Like, do I really have to go, right? So those people are the Nidachim Beretz Mitzrayim. They're comfortable. Things are okay. They're not looking to change. They're not looking for what's real. They're not looking for growth. They're just comfortable. It just is what it is. And those people take longer. It takes longer for them to see the truth. Until it's staring you in the face, until you can't deny it. And at the end of the process, the end of the Mitzrayim story, when they're standing on the sea and watching the Egyptian army float away, right? So then, Vayaminu b'Hashem, then they believe in God. So perhaps this emuna really takes place in parts. This source in 7 is, sometimes I like to do a little chazara, because when I bring these ideas, it's not just like as like a cute, like, oh, here's a cute study that might be helpful, that, you know, might tell us something. But it's because, like, I mean, I'm bringing them because I find they add to the picture. So this happens to be one that we've seen before. It's a study from, it's an article from Francesca Gino and co-authors about motivated reasoning. So about motivated beliefs. So that's kind of this idea that wealthier people often hold less favorable attitudes towards redistribution. Oh, what a coincidence. Right? For example, this group found that squatters and settlements in Argentina who were exogenously assigned property rights. So that basically means, it means that they didn't, one of the issues is like if they earned something, so then maybe they're just a certain kind of person. But what if they don't get property rights because of something they did, but like it's randomly assigned, right? There's a lottery and the government figures out who gets what. So if there's a random lottery and it's, so that's exogenous. It's outside of me. It's coming from somewhere else. So a group, right? A group of squatters who were like lottery assigned rights to the property, so they subsequently changed their perceptions of the inherent justice of a free market system, right? So all of a sudden, they were like, you know what? Actually, actually, the property owners are pretty good, and they should have the most rights, right? So all of a sudden, things turn around. So this idea of being motivated beliefs, this idea that sometimes when I have more, it kind of contributes to my belief system. So it's a little bit harder to break, right? So those who have more are motivated to hold on to it. So that's just to kind of add, it's a little chazar, something to think about, like how, right, if our beliefs only entirely line up with exactly what I happen to be doing, then maybe there are certain ways I should start to explore that, question that a little bit, right? Could it always possibly be true that everything I do just always happens to be 100% exactly correct? Okay, so maybe we want to think about that idea of motivated, right? Or am I motivated a little bit to believe that because that's the way, because that's what I have, because that's who I am? So that idea of motivated belief is to kind of build this idea that those in Mitzrayim, right, who had more, so then they don't think the Egyptian system, maybe it's not all that bad, right? Maybe it's not as bad. Oh, guys, come on, get over it. It's not so bad, right? Yeah, because they're the ones who have. And when Moshe comes to pass on this message, Vayamein Ha'am, maybe we should recognize that Vayamein Ha'am, maybe that is people, that is the group, that is overall, but that's not true of everybody. And maybe not until later, at the very end of the story, when you can't possibly deny the reality of God's hand in the story anymore, and you can't possibly get away from it, so then Vayaminu Ba'Hashem, right? And that, after we finish reading the Parsha, and we're reading through the Haftorah, right, this is the message of Yeshaya, that Yitaka B'Shofar Gadol, that in the future, right, those who are searching will find it easier, right? And that is the question. That is the question, just something to kind of leave with, this idea of that when Moshe comes, we almost picture like, oh, if only Moshe came, right? Oh, it's so hard right now. If only Moshe came and gave a message, that would be so much easier for me to get on board. Maybe it wasn't so easy then either, right? Moshe came, maybe not everybody was on board in the same way, right? If you had a different, slightly different experience, maybe you were not bought into Moshe's message in the same way, right? And maybe it's easy for us to say, if only Moshe were here now, then it would be clear to me. But maybe that's not really the most important factor. Maybe that's not the only thing that contributes. So that's the idea, something to think about, right? Are we in Assyria or are we in Egypt, right? Are we searching? Are we searching and maybe we don't always hit the mark because we're searching in the wrong place? Or sometimes are we not really searching? We just, we're comfortable and we think we're in the right place because we're not really looking for more. Something to think about. So the Parsha, right, is to add a little layers, some different layers to the Egypt story as we go through, thinking about the slavery. That slavery, we kind of have very broad picture of it, but maybe if we get into the details and think a little bit more about the life experience of going through it, maybe was not exactly the same. It explains this emunah at the beginning, and it explains the emunah at the end. Maybe it didn't stop in the middle. Maybe there were people who didn't really have it until the end. And thinking for ourselves, right, am I somebody who is in Ashur, who's trying to do the right thing and not hitting and not in the right place, or perhaps sometimes am I in Egypt and maybe I should be exploring a little bit more?
Well, if someone came to